Strange Intruders. The next hour, we'll take your phone calls. Maybe you've stumbled upon a black-eyed child or some of these other creatures you're going to hear about in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. David Weatherly with us now. David, Strange Intruders. Tell me about this. How did it come about?
Strange Intruders is a collection of a wide range of entity encounters. It sort of grew out of these things that I have been pursuing for so many years. And George, actually, this is the book I set out to write initially, and it kind of turned into the Black-Eyed Children book. What happened was I was writing a book about a wide range of different encounters, and I had so many reports of those black-eyed children that it sort of took on a life of its own and became a separate book. So after it had come out, I went back to some of the original material and completed the current book, Strange Intruder. So it covers a whole range of things. It covers the grinning man, the djinn, which is something that I have received so many emails about. It has a chapter on black-eyed beings, shadow people, and just a number of different things within the paranormal that people have been encountering. A few historical accounts to show that these weird encounters have been going on for a very, very long time, and we're starting to reach a new peak in the cycle of these types of encounters.
And our mutual friend, Micah Hanks, was just on with me on the program, wrote your forward to the Strange Intruders. And that's always a good way to do it. Now, tell me a little bit about, let's go right through the chapters if we can. Tell me a little bit about grinning men. Who are they?
The grinning man, the term I believe was coined by John Keel from a case that he investigated in the 1960s. There was a UFO flap in New Jersey, and a pair of boys walking home one evening saw this bizarre figure standing just off the interstate against a fence, and he was extremely tall. He was wearing this odd green jumpsuit with a huge silver belt and this incredibly large grin on his face. Really disturbed these two young men and caused them to rush off. And the account later was given to John Keel, and he interviewed the boys, found them to be very credible. And he started looking into the whole concept of these grinning men, which he found a number of historical cases and also found other cases when he was investigating. Just a weird figure. It's variously described as being human by most accounts, but usually they're dressed in some bizarre fashion, a bright checkered shirt or, wild shock of white hair sometimes. There was one that townspeople pursued this gentleman, and he made these incredible leaps across a field and across a wide open ditch that the men pursuing him just couldn't replicate. So they often show up connected to waves of UFO sightings or particular UFO encounters, and no one really knows exactly what they are. We don't know if they're just some strange humans or if they're aliens or what the manifestation is. And oddly enough, they never really seem to do anything other than just sort of appear and cause a little bit of a ruckus, and then they're gone.
Do you like to have somebody come up to you and just smile? That's kind of weird, isn't it?
Well, it's much, sometimes the very subtle things are even more disturbing. There is an account in the book. I actually saw one of these things in the 1980s, and it was a very, very strange experience. It was with a friend of mine who was driving. We were on a back road in North Carolina, and not really any houses. Every 10 miles or so, maybe you'd see a home. And we had hit this stretch where there was, just raw land, trees, not really any room to pull the car off on the side of the road. We rounded this curve, and we were approaching another curve. And up ahead on the right-hand side, I was in the passenger seat, I see this figure standing just off the road. And, of course, this is a very bizarre thing to see anyone. You never saw anyone walking out there or anything. And here this gentleman is standing in the weeds, just sort of looking towards our car. And George, it was so bizarre because as we approached this person, it was one of those moments where things just seemed to move in slow motion.
Yeah.
And we had such a good view of him because he was so close to the road. He was very tall. He was wearing a sort of a top hat and this long coat. He had on this bright belt underneath the coat, and he had one hand under his chin, sort of rubbing his fingers together, and this impossibly large grin. I honestly couldn't believe what I was seeing. It reminded me of the Joker, you know, the Batman villain with this hideously huge grin. Now, the fellow who was driving, his name was Tom, and he, of course, you know, sped up as soon as we had passed this thing, and I immediately am telling him to stop and turn around. So I had spun my head around to look out the rear view, the rear window, and when I did, this grinning man was already standing in the road watching our car. So somehow he had just leapt on the road or something and is watching us, you know, go away. Tom wanted nothing to do with it. He was convinced it was some type of, you know, crazy slasher or psycho or something. And
well, you never know nowadays.
Well, you don't. This is, you know, this is the 1980s. And it took some real badgering with him to get him to at least turn the car around and go back. I said, I just want to see if he's still standing there. And finally convinced him to do it. He turned around. We went back. He got close to the spot. And I of course, leapt out of the car, because I had to go investigate closer. And he was, you know, Tom was pitching a fit that if I didn't get in the car, he was leaving me. I wanted to see if there was any evidence of this person. And there was nothing. I couldn't find any tire tracks on the side of the road, not that there was room to pull off. There were some weeds that were mashed down where someone that appeared to have been standing. But there was no sign of this character anywhere, just nothing. And you know, we left the scene, and a few strange things happened later. There were some UFO sightings in the area later that night. And years later, when I had talked to John Keel about this whole grinning man phenomena, I told him about my encounter, and he said, you know, you need to keep poking around. You'll find that there are more UFO sightings around that time period. And indeed, he was correct. I looked into it further and eventually found a group in the neighboring state that had cataloged some UFO sightings around that time, and another person who had seen what she described as a hobo clown running across the road one evening as she was driving home. And this is all right in the same time frame. So, again, these grinning men, they seem to manifest around UFO sightings for some reason.
That's interesting. Okay, let's get into the jinn. You had mentioned them earlier. Of course, very predominant in the Middle East. Are they genies? What are they?
The jinn, first of all, George, I got to tell you, even after the Black Eyed Children book came out, I have received more emails and communications with questions about the jinn than I have anything else.
Really?
Very strange. Huh. And the, you know, the attention that's been directed towards these things in recent years, I think is warranted. I think it's a very serious concern. In the West, of course, most people are familiar with the term genie, but unfortunately, what that conjures in most minds is one of two things, either the fat blue Disney, you know, animated character that is just helping Aladdin or whatever, or if you're a little bit older, it conjures, you know, Barbara Eden to mind, bumbling her magic and running around in harem pants. And both of those are very trivialized versions of what the jinn actually are, because when you start looking into the lore of these things, they're pretty sinister.
Yeah.
And they go far, far back in history. Now, is Islamic teaching is that Allah created three races. He created man, he created angels, and he created the jinn. Now, as the lore unfolds, the jinn refused to acknowledge the superiority of humans, so they were banished.
Where have we heard that before, huh?
Right. But, you know, the banishment in that lore is not really, it's not to some netherworld. All of the beliefs from the Middle East and other areas where there's a heavy Muslim presence are that the jinn are all around us. They can dwell in anything, and anywhere can hold jinn. So abandoned buildings, you know, the desert, deserted places. And what you find as you follow sort of the trail of history is that you get into the medieval and Renaissance period, and what was happening where there were a lot of sorcerers intentionally trying to bind jinn to objects. Often it would be jewelry, a ring, a necklace, a bracelet, things like this. And they were selling these things. You know, here's an item with a powerful jinn that you can command. This is where we get the legend of the genie in a bottle or genie in a lamp. It's this idea that the spirit has been bound to an object that the possessor can then control. But these things aren't something that can be controlled. You know, even if they appear to be under your command initially, it usually just means trouble.
It sure does. Well, you know, so many cultures are believing in the jinn, as you said. But why do you think at this point we're getting a lot of attention about them? What's going on that was going to necessitate that?
Well, I'll tell you why. For over 10 years now, there's been a heavy Western military presence in the Middle East. So we have large numbers of military personnel who are encountering a culture that, you know, firmly believes in these things as part of their spiritual path. If you're a practicing Muslim, you believe in jinn. That's all there is to it. So we have Westerners encountering this culture for, you know, 10 plus years now, and a lot of military personnel bringing things back home with them. So I receive accounts all the time from military people who have come home from the Middle East, being deployed over there, and they're having a string of misfortunes. They're having poltergeist-like activity in their homes. They're having illnesses in their family. And it inevitably traces back to something that they brought home, a, quote, souvenir that they found or that they purchased in a market. And it's often a piece of jewelry or an object that they were told was enchanted with a powerful jinn.
What do the jinn want? What are they after?
The jinn, when you start looking at the history of these things, they're very resentful because they were forced into a different type of existence due to their noncompliance with the demands of Allah. And so they have an agenda that essentially is to get back at humans, to seek revenge. They're very sinister at the worst, and at the least they are very trickster-like in that they like to cause chaos and trouble. So typically what happens in a lot of these encounters is that initially they will start making contact with the person whose proximity they have come into, and it will take the form of voices, psychic information. You know, they can assume the voice of a person's deceased mother or other relatives, and they will initially start to give guidance and good information. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll lead people to jobs or money or better homes and so forth. But what they do is they build this dependence on the information and on the contact with the person. You see, they're causing that door to open wider and wider, because the more the person listens and accepts the advice and the information, the more they're opening themselves to this entity. And it creates this level of connection that allows the jinn to exert more and more control and more influence. But then, once they have the person thoroughly entrapped, the information takes on a darker turn, and they start leading the person to very, very bad things, you know, misfortunes, and they start causing chaos. They start causing trouble in the person's home with various levels of poltergeist activity and so forth. And it's all about their agenda, and it's that trickster-like nature that allows them to really get to a person.
So they do these little tricks, you know, much like that little character in the Superman comics used to do a long time ago. Are they out to hurt people, David?
Absolutely. I believe that they are, yes. I've seen so many cases of these things, and it just leads to, you know, terrible things for the family, physical accidents and other types of harm. So, yes, I believe that they are.
Okay, now you also have devoted a chapter to shadow people, of course. We talk a lot about them. What are you coming down to as a conclusion about shadow people?
Shadow people, I think that there are a number of reasons these things manifest. I think at times I believe that they are residual spiritual energy that people are making contact with. You know, this is probably one of the most widely reported types of paranormal phenomena, and we've seen it for so many years. You can trace the history of these shadow beings way back. You know, initially people would report seeing these monk-like figures, you know, these shadow figures that appeared to be wearing hooded robes and would just appear in different areas. And then it sort of evolved to where we were seeing what's called the Hat Man. And people would describe this tall shadow being that appeared to be wearing a large brimmed hat, would appear in their bedrooms or in their homes. Now we have a few variations. People still report the Hat Man. They also report these other shadow figures that are a little bit less defined, but exhibit these glowing red eyes, and they seem to be a little bit more malicious in their intent. I think we're seeing a wide range of manifestations of these things because there are different reasons they're manifesting. So, as I said, sometimes I think it's residual spiritual energy. Sometimes I think it's caused almost as a psychological reaction or projection from the person who's involved. So we sort of get into tulpa territory a little bit with some of these manifestations.
The shadow people, you know, a lot of people have, as far as I'm concerned, have not reported getting hurt, but they do see these strange beings. I think those are dimensional, David.
Oh, yes, I think so too. But now, there are some encounters that are starting to surface of physical contact with these things. In fact, there's one in Strange Intruders. It's just very stunning. This gentleman started seeing these things in his home, and it unfolded over the course of about a year. And initially, he was just seeing them sort of out of the corner of his eye, and they would be darting around the home. It developed to where they started to do physical things. He would feel a light touch on his back.
So they're getting aggressive.
They're getting aggressive, yes. And this particular one developed to the point where he virtually was attacked by one of these things and, you know, felt it grab him and try to essentially drag him under the bed. And we are starting to see a few of these cases manifest here and there where people are reporting that somehow these things are gaining enough energy to make physical contact with people here in our world.
All right, David, stay with us. We're going to come back and talk more about strange intruders and some of these other creatures that are out there. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. David Weatherly, our special guest, as we go through his book, Strange Intruders. When we come back, we'll talk more about some of these intruders in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, David Weatherly with us. David, let us talk now about something very strange called puckwudgies. What the heck are puckwudgies?
Puckwudgies are connected mainly to the Wampanoags in southeastern Massachusetts, a Native American tribe. What these are essentially little people, and they're described as being rather troll-like, three and a half feet tall. They're usually described as wearing clothing that looks like it's made of natural materials like bark and leaves and so forth. Now, what's fascinating about this, there are a couple of things. One, most people, when you say, you talk about the wee folk or little people, of course, their minds automatically go to Ireland and, you know, the leprechauns and so forth, or perhaps Scandinavia with the gnomes and the trolls. A lot of people don't realize Native American tribes all over North America have legends of these small beings that used to live here on the land and still exist on some level. The Utes talk about them, the Cherokee, wide range of tribes. The Pukwudgies in Massachusetts are very unique for a couple of reasons. One, people are still reporting seeing these things today. Two, the legend that revolves around them talks about the cultural hero of the people called Mashop, who had a battle with these Pukwudgies. And curiously enough, in their tribal lore, their cultural hero loses to these things. The Pukwudgies win, and they become nasty little creatures. They have turned on the humans at this point, and they cause trouble. They lead people to their deaths, and they, in general, create a lot of chaos. So it's pretty fascinating to look at the historical aspects of the legends, but then when you come forward in time and realize that a lot of people are still reporting these things. Now, some of the reports come out of the infamous Bridgewater Triangle, an area in the Northeast that is known for wide range of all types of weird manifestations, from cryptids, the UFOs, to other types of bizarre figures. Shadow people are reported in there, and these Pukwudgies, and people are encountering these things in the Triangle and in state parks in the region, and there are tales of these Pukwudgies trying to lead people to cliffs and other dangerous locations, perhaps to lure them to their deaths.
What's so amazing about all these intruders, David, is that they're so widespread in terms of variety, and they're all over the place. I mean, something's happening here.
Absolutely. And I tried to convey that with the book and give people a sense of these things. It's really a worldwide phenomenon. You can go to any country and just about any region in any given country and find some kind of strange tales. And while they're vastly different, there are also often some common threads that seem to connect these things. And it gives you this sense that, hence the title of the book, that something is in sort of intruding into our world.
There is a former security guard named Piero Fortunato Zanfretta.
Oh, goodness.
Tell me about this case.
George, one of my favorite cases, hands down. This is so fascinating. This occurred in Italy in 1978. Italy was experiencing a huge wave of UFO sightings. People reporting different types of accounts from all over the country. In the midst of it, December 6th of 1978, Zanfretta, who's working as a private security guard, goes out to check on the home of this doctor who is not at home. The security company is in charge of checking on his home. Zanfretta is by himself. It's a freezing night. It's sleeting. He gets to the home. He sees lights behind the house. He is convinced that burglars have broken into the doctor's home, and he's going to apprehend them. So he draws his revolver. He creeps into the yard of the home. He's walking along very carefully when he feels something touch him from behind. He spins around and he sees what he described as a 10-foot tall creature. Jeez. With undulating skin. Now, I don't know about you, but that description is creepy enough for me.
Yeah, I would think so.
he goes on and he talks about this thing wearing a green tunic, and it has these weird triangular shapes on its head. Zanfretta passes out. He makes it to his car first, and he calls for backup. And when the backup arrives, it takes a couple of hours because of the road conditions. The two officers who arrive find Zanfretta laying on the freezing ground. He jumps up when he sees these officers and waves his gun at them. They are able to disarm him. And they find that despite the fact that he was laying on the frozen ground, he's completely warm. Now, George, this case gets more and more fascinating the further into it goes. The Italian military police were called to investigate this encounter. What they found were these weird impressions in the yard behind the doctor's home. Furthermore, they found that there were 52 witnesses in the village who saw these lights rising up over this home. Now, Zanfretta reported that what he saw rising over the home before he blacked out was a triangular-shaped craft larger than the house. Zanfretta's encounters continue because later that same month, he is in a situation where he encounters something again. He's driving in his patrol car. Again, he's by himself. He radios into the station that, something to the effect that they're here. I'm getting out of the car now. Backup is once again sent. The military police are again called to investigate the situation. When they find Zanfretta this time, it's been pouring rain, but Zanfretta is laying in a field. He's warm and dry. Not only that, but when the police investigate his vehicle, they find that it's hot as an oven, both inside and out. His revolver has been fired. He doesn't have any recollection as to why or what he shot at. He undergoes hypnosis because at this point, so much media attention has been put on him that he wants to try to get to the bottom of it. And he describes an encounter with these weird aliens that he described initially in the first account.
Under hypnosis.
Now, it gets more fascinating as it goes along because the Italian military police were very perplexed by the whole case, and they're finding physical evidence during these situations. For instance, when Zanfretta was found laying in the field, his car burning up like an oven, they found shoe prints around his vehicle. Towards the shoe prints were 20 inches long and 8 inches wide.
20 inches long and 8 inches wide.
Long and 8 inches wide. Massive shoe prints.
Did they look like shoes?
They did look like shoes.
Okay.
Now, what gets really fascinating is that as the encounters unfold, and this is a very complex case. We could talk about this all night. But just hitting a few of the high points, Zanfretta has so much media attention put on him, and he's getting a fashion of people that are ridiculing him, saying he's making all this up. It's all phony.
Even under hypnosis.
Even under hypnosis. So, George, he agrees to undergo hypnosis again.
Again.
On national television. But this time, he's dosed with sodium pentothal.
Truth serum.
So, dosed with truth serum, put under hypnosis, he gives the exact same account. The doctor who administered the truth serum said that it's just impossible that anyone could lie under that strong a dose of truth serum. He's telling the truth about what he believes he encountered.
Well, see, and that's important. Their belief and what had happened to them, probably one and the same. But if he truly believes he saw this, like Barney and Betty Hill, you got to believe him.
Exactly. And he had nothing to gain, and he gained nothing from the entire situation. I mean, he was he's a fairly simple guy when these things started to unfold. He never wanted media attention, and he tried to avoid it when he could. He only submitted to some of it because he wanted to try to salvage his reputation. And, meanwhile, you've got the Italian military police investigating this. They've also reported to the Department of the Interior and to the Italian military, who are both interested in the case. But as they continue their investigation, I love this, January 1980, the Italian military police finally decide that they have to close the case, so they rubber stamp it. No crime committed. End of story.
Jeez. Is he still alive?
Zanfretta is still alive as far as I know. I've recently been in touch with a gentleman named Rino Di Stefano, who wrote the only book about this case. Unfortunately, it's only in Italian at this point. But he still is is actively involved, and he's hoping to get the book translated into English at some point. But it's such a fascinating case. And the sort of high point and end point of this thing was that Zanfretto was abducted one final time when he was riding his motorcycle. And I think this was the last abduction. He was abducted again, and purportedly these aliens, who he constantly insisted he wanted nothing to do with, and says that he told the aliens he wanted nothing to do with them.
Right. They're kind of disrupting his life, weren't they?
Exactly. And he tried to be very insistent with him, but in his final encounter with these aliens, they gave him what he described as a sphere with a pyramid inside of it that was putting off some type of energy. And they told him that they wanted him to take this sphere to a man named Dr. J. Allen Hynek.
Ah, yes. One of the best.
Zanfretta had no idea who Dr. Hynek was. He'd never heard the name. And, again, he didn't want anything to do with these aliens. So, according to his account, he took this sphere and buried it in the hills somewhere. Unfortunately, of course, Dr. Hynek passed away in, 86, I believe.
Yeah.
So, there was never a connection made between the two men, so we really don't know whether Zanfretta would have produced that thing to give it to Hynek or not.
That's a great story. I mean, there's the other great story was the former police officer who has since died, Zamora, and his thing of his sightings in New Mexico. I mean, those are incredible. What is Slender Man? That comes up a lot.
Oh, boy. That's one that gets a lot of people kind of riled up. Now, let me say right at the top here that Slender Man was an internet creation. Okay? We have a very defined, documentable history of this thing. What happened with the Slender Man was, he was the result of a contest that was run on a forum. The forum was called Something Awful. And the challenge that was posed was, let's create a paranormal-themed image that we can make go viral on the internet and make people believe that it's real.
Okay.
So initially, people were submitting different ideas. They were photoshopping cryptids and aliens and all types of wild things. Well, along comes an entry that is, again, one of those things that's very subtle. I talked about this sort of slim figure that was spotted in the background of some photographs, was vaguely connected to some tragedies that had occurred.
It looks like a praying mantis.
Sort of. He's depicted as a humanoid-type figure, very tall. No defined face. It's usually just a sort of as if there's a caul over the face, or no real defined features. Very long arms, sometimes extra appendages that seem to sway about almost like tree limbs. And very dark, appears to be wearing a dark suit. And again, is seen in the background of these images. And he wasn't even given a name initially. There were a couple of names that were thrown around. The Operator was one. The Slender Man, two words, later evolved into the singular Slender Man. And as the story unfolds, more and more people begin to contribute to it. The entire thread was taken over with the concept of the Slender Man. And he is generally a figure who is, he's sort of a boogeyman. He lurks in the background. He is possibly responsible for disappearances and connected to some strange tragedies. As it began to evolve, a couple of key things happened. One, a gentleman created a video series that was posted on the internet called Marvel Hornets. And Marvel Hornets was an unfolding story done in segments about a college film that was being made, and the whole long involved thing about how the producer suddenly stops making the film because something strange has happened to him, and he has all this footage that he ends up giving to this friend of his, and then the producer disappears. So now there are people actively talking about current disappearances connected to this Slender Man. And coinciding with this, we get people throwing in historical connections to the Slender Man. Someone promoted a series of woodblocks purportedly from the 1500s in Germany that depicted this creature. So he sort of morphs into a boogeyman that's been there for a very long time, and you see the legend merge with some older tales like the German Dark Man and some other cultural beliefs from around the world. Now, what's curious about the Slender Man is that
he's got tentacles, too, doesn't he?
He has tentacles. He has these long extra arms that are constantly swaying out, and perhaps he can, purportedly uses those to snatch children or people and take them somewhere. We don't know where. But the Slender Man sort of makes a leap, across the fence, in a sense, in that independently, people start reporting encounters with this thing. Now, George, I know you had callers to coast, frantic people reporting encounters with this Slender Man. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of these accounts that have surfaced in the last several years, people who are convinced that this thing is not an internet creation, that it is actually a real creature that is lurking in the shadows and, stalking people sometimes.
Have you heard of that story of have you dreamed this man? Apparently, a lot of people have dreamed of a man who's, and he's on the internet. He's very strange. He's got a strange face. But hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people are dreaming about this guy.
I have seen that. It's very curious. It's as if something is, activating in the collective consciousness. And I haven't really delved into that much, but I have definitely seen the reports. It seems very intriguing. And it's in the same territory that this Slender Man figure is. With the Slender Man, I tend to believe, and this kind of aggravates some people, but I think that we might be co-creating this thing into existence. Because when you go back to the basic principles of the idea of a tulpa, which is a Tibetan term for a being that is created from pure thought into physical form. You start looking at all these old concepts from different cultures about how if you put energy towards something, you bring it into being, you co-create it. And with this Slender Man, we've got thousands and thousands of people focusing on the idea of this very negative, dark entity that exists out there.
Well, we're going to take some calls with you when we come right back, David, and who knows what we'll find.